The World is supported by Israel Story, a podcast that tells extraordinary stories about regular people living in Israel, the kind you won't see on the news or online. The show kicked off season four with a miniseries called The Wall, beginning with the gorgeous tale of a Jewish Arab baby born at the Western Wall in the middle of the Six-Day War. Hosted by Mishy Harman and brought to you by Tablet Magazine and PRX. Subscribe to Israel Story on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, israelstory.org, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Rudy Giuliani's ties to Ukraine get murkier, and for some Ukrainians, they don't smell good.
Smells like an attempt to provide additional favors for one of the candidates on American elections.
Also, Turkey continues to bomb targets in Syria. For Syrians living in Turkey, it's making a difficult time even harder.
I have every day to call my friends one by one to ask, are you okay? Did you get home safely? And all of us, we already feel unsafe. But we start to feel unsafe more.
And a marathoner tries to accomplish the impossible this weekend with some help.
He'll have 41 pace setters hopping in and out of the course. These guys are world-class runners themselves. They'll also shield him from any wind resistance.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you here. The list of Ukrainian names we're becoming familiar with is growing. Add to it now Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. Parnas and Fruman are Soviet-born U.S. citizens and associates of President Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani. But instead of getting on that flight Wednesday, the men were taken to a Virginia courtroom and charged with conspiring to violate a ban on foreign political donations. President Trump was photographed with the two men at the White House last year.
Somebody said there may be a picture or something where at a fundraiser or somewhere. But I have pictures with everybody.
Have you talked to them?
I don't know if there's anybody I don't have pictures with. I don't know them. I don't know about them. I don't know what they do. But I don't know. Maybe they were clients of Rudy. You'd have to ask Rudy.
There's still a lot we don't know about Giuliani's ties to Ukraine. Ukrainian journalist Sergei Lyshenko can help us. Foreign Policy magazine called Lyshenko the Ukrainian who sunk Paul Manafort. As you'll recall, Manafort is Trump's former campaign manager, now serving time. Sergei, this is somewhat complex. We know that Rudy Giuliani was hunting for dirt on Joe Biden and his son Hunter in Ukraine. What do you make of this news of the arrest of these two alleged Giuliani associates? Does it surprise you?
Not because these people, they were circulating here around in Kyiv. They were working as mediators to establish the contact between Mr. Giuliani and Mr. Zelensky. And their name is quite well known now here in Ukraine, and their background is not really clear.
But the news does not surprise you.
It's not surprised me because the whole story, it smells like an attempt to provide additional favors for one of the candidates on American elections.
When did you first hear about Rudy Giuliani's involvement in Ukraine?
It was about April, May this year when Mr. Giuliani announced his trip to Kyiv to meet with President-elect Vladimir Zelensky. At the same time, Mr. Fruman and Mr. Parnas, they met with some of his advisors with the idea, let's have a meeting between Zelensky and Giuliani.
Well, in May of 2019, that would be Rudy Giuliani's decision not to go to Ukraine. There's a moment on Fox News where Giuliani raises your name as part of this whole story.
I'm not going to go because I think I'm walking into a group of people that are enemies of the president, in some cases enemies of the United States, and in one case, an already convicted person who has been found to be involved in assisting the Democrats with the 2016 election.
Okay, so
a gentleman,
let me ask
I'll give you his name.
Your decision
a gentleman
not
by
to
the
go.
Name of,
your decision not to go.
Let me okay. finish. A gentleman by the name of Lyshenko.
Yes.
Who supplied a black book that was found to be fraudulent.
Giuliani claimed there that black ledger is fraudulent.
No, this ledger is not a fraud. It's a real document, and the Ukrainian law enforcement institutions, they made official expertise of the signatures in this book, and these signatures were found real, not a fake one.
So this was the ledger of former President Viktor Yanukovych. It was kind of his way of keeping track of a lot of illegal stuff, and in it were the payments to Paul Manafort.
Yes, correct.
We should point out, Sergei, that you weren't just a minister of parliament, you're also an investigative reporter. What made you expose these documents?
I was really angry at Mr. Manafort since he was working for our ousted president Yanukovych. Mr. Manafort made Yanukovych president of Ukraine, and Mr. Yanukovych started to steal money of Ukrainian taxpayers and put Ukraine in this nightmare of the war with Russia. Mr. Manafort made a bad service for Ukraine, and I believe he was properly convicted by American judicial system.
So in Ukraine, are you able to be an investigative reporter and dig for dirt on politicians and be a member of parliament at the same time?
In Ukraine, it's legal. You can combine this activity by law.
Even the perception, though, that you are a politician or were and an investigative reporter, do you think that gave Giuliani license to say you're working for the Democrats? Because that's what he said. Are you? And were you ever?
It's not true. I was never instructed or ordered by Democrats to produce this evidence about Manafort.
What do you think is the liability for people in U.S. political circles, including Paul Manafort, Rudolph Giuliani, the Bidens, when they get involved with Ukrainian oligarchs and politicians?
In Ukraine, Ukrainian oligarchs, they would like to establish relations with American establishment, American politicians, American think tanks, and they go to people like Manafort or Giuliani to find such contacts for the very good payment.
Sergei Lyshenko, a Ukrainian journalist in Kyiv, he's a former member of parliament there, where he exposed documents that incriminated former campaign manager Paul Manafort in 2016. Sergei Lyshenko, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for inviting, and let's stay in touch.
I would love that. Thank you very much. How is Paul Manafort connected to presidential treason in Ukraine? We have that story at theworld.org. Ethiopia got some big news today. In Oslo, Berit Riis-Andersen, the chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, walked up to the podium and announced the winner of this year's Nobel Peace Prize.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed Ali, for his efforts to achieve peace and...
Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed Ali was awarded the prize for leading Ethiopia and neighboring Eritrea to sign a peace accord after 20 years of tension between the two nations. It had immediate results. The border between Ethiopia and Eritrea reopened after years of isolation. Families reunited. In July of last year, we saw photos and videos of that first joyous flight from Ethiopia to Eritrea after the peace deal. Captain Yosef Hailu of Ethiopian Airlines was a pilot on that historic flight. He joins us now from Addis Ababa. Captain, you got to experience firsthand the peace dividend created by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Describe what that flight was like going into Eritrea last year.
I feel about that flight as if it's yesterday. You know, I can still feel the excitement, you know. The excitement, of course, started a day before, you know, when I was assigned on that flight. Going to Asmara was like going to my homeland. When I first graduated from the pilot training school, you know, a little over 30 years ago, I was assigned in Asmara. You know, that was my first flight. So I know Asmara over 34, 35 years ago.
So you had flown that route, Addis Ababa to Asmara, many times in the past. But then with the tensions, everything just stopped. For you personally, what did it mean to kind of land in Asmara last year?
To be assigned on that flight was like a privilege, you know, going back to your home land. You know, we two countries share so many things in common, you know, same culture, same religion, language, food. So flying there, the mood was different, you know, just started here from Addis Ababa. Up there, I just announced it, crossing Ethiopian and Eritrean border. So the mood in the cabin is completely different. You cannot express it in words.
Yeah, what was it like?
Oh, shouting, crying, open. You know, Ethiopian Airlines prepared a big cake and champagne, you know, to be opened on the flight.
Wow.
To be blessed on the flight. That cake was cut, the champagne opened, but most of the passengers even opened their own champagnes. You know, it was crying, shouting. Most of the passengers, they just boarded the aircraft. Probably they have separated from their family they haven't seen their parents, their siblings for over 20 years. Most of them, they don't even know their whereabouts. You know, they were carrying pictures of their family and they just boarded the flight. When we just landed, everybody was crying, looking for their, for the loved ones. They just hugging and crying. it was completely, completely different. You know, I cannot express it in words, you know.
So you saw a lot of beautiful reunions. Was that flight sold out? I have to assume it was.
Oh, exactly. About a week ago, it was sold out. It was completely full.
Captain, what was your reaction today when you heard that your Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, had won the Nobel Peace Prize?
You know, I'm still thrilled, you know. I mean, you know, this Nobel Peace Prize award, it's not only for Prime Minister Dr. Abiy, you know, but it is a pride and a recognition of to the entire nation, you know, to the whole people. So if you can come to Addis Ababa and look the city, it's completely different. You go to a bar, I see the moon and the atmosphere, you know, it's completely different. Everyone is thrilled.
Well, I have not been to Addis Ababa since 2005. I'm really excited to see what happens there. Captain Yosef Hailu of Ethiopian Airlines, the first pilot on that first historic flight last year to Asmara from Addis Ababa. Thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
An Iranian oil tanker may have been hit by two missiles today. The tanker was traveling off the Saudi Arabian coast. The ship has two holes and is leaking oil. The tanker company said the holes look like they could be from a missile, but, quote, we are not sure. Iranian officials have not assigned blame. Nearby, Iraq is also simmering after being gripped by days of violent protests earlier this month. Laith Kuba is a senior advisor to Iraq's prime minister, Adil Abdulmahdi. I asked him what the protests are all about.
It's mainly driven by young people who are graduates either of high schools or of universities looking for work, as well as many, many others who struggle in day-to-day work. There are no job opportunities for them, and there is no prospect for a better life. The streets that they use, the hospitals, the schools, they all need work. And to them, there is a very simple question. Why can't you fix it? So these protests are very much demanding better quality of life and objecting strongly to the squandering of the country's wealth.
Mr. Kuba, let's turn to the violence that's been unleashed by these protests. The protesters are not armed, and yet more than 150 of them have been killed, mostly shot dead. Why are they being shot if they're not armed?
There is an investigation. I think the key ministers made it clear, and the prime minister made it clear, the president made it clear, that the government did not issue any orders to fire on protesters. So the question, who shot the protesters? Now, some of those who were killed by snipers, straight bullets, either to the heart or to the head. It's not clear who they belong to, what cover they're using, and who instructed them. Of course, it's a cause of alarm to us citizens, not only myself as a member in the government, but those citizens, they're extremely alarmed. And this is one of the top issues that's being raised in Baghdad.
I mean, those numbers of people killed and the reports of snipers suggest enormous coordination by them. I mean, how can you not know who they are?
Because Iraq went through not only many wars, but had militias in the past. And we had popular forces mobilization that fought the war on Daesh. Now, recently, those forces have been integrated with the army. It is probable or possible that maybe some rogue groups here and there, undisciplined, ill-trained, they act on their own, they act on somebody's instructions. That is possible. And as I said, the government is investigating. I think in some cases, it turned out some, let's say, undisciplined members of the police or the army has fired, but not because they've got orders. But as I said, the large numbers suggest, especially those snipers, those are professionals. So they must have a command structure and somebody must have ordered them. And this is part of the government investigation.
Will you stay for the record that your government has nothing to do with these snipers?
Yes, I heard it directly from the president and from Minister of Defense and the Minister of Interior that categorically they have not issued any orders to open fire. In fact, to the contrary, they've been given instructions that no fires should be shot in confronting the demonstrators. The riot police was at the front line, and the riot police does not carry live ammunition.
Meanwhile, really huge events unfolding among your neighbors. What is the position of the Iraqi government toward the Turkish military operations happening in Syria?
In particular, Iraq is concerned because we expect there will be Kurdish refugees coming to Iraq. So another wave of refugees is a bit problematic and destabilizing. These are concerns that we have.
Laith Kuba, senior advisor to Iraq's prime minister, speaking with us from Baghdad. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thousands of Liberians living in the U.S. are facing an ominous deadline. Come March, the Trump administration is halting a program that allows Liberians to live and work here. A group of Liberians is suing the government, and earlier this week had their first day in federal court here in Massachusetts. The World's Tanya Karas has been following this, and she's with me in the studio. Tell us about this program, first of all, Tanya, and the people who are at risk of losing this legal status.
This program, which is called Deferred Enforced Departure, or DED, it allows people from certain countries experiencing war or natural disasters to stay in the U.S. temporarily. And DED right now covers about 4,000 Liberians. Most of them came to the U.S. during Liberia's civil war, which lasted for many years. And Trump ended the DED program because he said it's no longer in the United States foreign policy interest for them to stay here. So it's set to end on March 31st. And that's bad news for people who have spent a huge chunk of their lives here in the U.S. They live here legally, they pay taxes, they go to American schools. People like Yata Kiazolu, she's a 28-year-old PhD student at UCLA, and she's been living in the U.S. since she was very young.
Terminating the program has meant, you know, great uncertainty. I'm supposed to be filing my dissertation, and the kind of interruptions over the last 2 years because of the termination has meant that I can't plan a certain future. I don't know what going on the job market looks like. I don't know what the next couple of years will look like for me.
You came to the United States when you were 6 years old. Have you been back to Liberia since then? Do you know what life is currently like there?
So I visited once, but other than that, I've never lived in Liberia. So the program terminating means that I would be expected to self-deport to a country I've never lived in.
Wow. So Tanya, she would be going back to a country she barely knows.
Yes. And similarly, you know, for lots of other Liberians, this affects not only them, but their children. There's at least another 4,000 children, many of them who are U.S. citizens, who would be affected by this decision. So the Liberians with DED status, they would be faced with some really difficult choices. As of March, they can either stay here undocumented or they can return to Liberia without their children. And so earlier this year, a group of Liberians with DED sued the Trump administration to stop him from terminating the program.
And my understanding is just a few days ago, they had their first day in federal court, right?
Yes. And it was a very emotional morning. There was a group of about 70 people, Liberians with DED status and their allies. They gathered here in Massachusetts before the hearing, and they were chanting.
We're immigrants.
And proud.
We're Africans.
And proud.
We're Liberians.
And proud.
We're DED.
Several people spoke. One of them was Othello Dennis. He is a Liberian DED holder. He's also a social worker. He is the father of two young American citizen children.
We are here today to tell Trump that we cannot go back. We cannot go back. We have our roots here. We have work here. For me, I'm a social worker. I've been a social worker here for almost 19 years. I served the immigrant children. I served the American children.
And then he led everybody into the courtroom.
So inside the courthouse, Tanya, what were the arguments you heard from both sides?
The Trump administration argued that this program exists at the president's discretion. He can extend it or terminate it at any time. The defense argued that Trump is terminating the program based on racial animus or racial prejudice toward immigrants. And you may recall, Marco, some of the vulgar comments that Trump has made about African countries and immigrants generally. And some of that was brought up in court. And the defense asked the judge to consider those comments, and they asked him to keep the DED program alive. And we did reach out to the Department of Justice for comment on the allegations that the Trump administration is being racist, and they declined to comment.
but it's supposed to be ending on March 31st, and that's the kind of end of the road for these Liberians. And so, what's next for the people who have the status? Are they preparing to leave?
Well, the future is really unclear. You know, people are really unsure whether they should start packing up their lives here, but they're really hoping that the judge will find some way to keep the program alive. And, you know, that woman that we introduced earlier, Yata Kiazolu, she's the only one in her family with DED. So she might be in a situation where she would be the only person in her family who has to leave, and she would have to leave everybody else, her parents and her siblings, behind.
There is a lot at stake. The World's Tanya Karas, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
What is the limit of human athletic ability? Tomorrow in Vienna, a long-distance runner will try to push the envelope to find out. The World's Jessica Yarmosky has that story.
Here's a moment that made marathon history.
He comes towards the line, raises a sprint on those magical legs.
That's Eliud Kipchoge from Kenya and his magical legs crossing the finish line of the Berlin Marathon in 2018. He broke the world record that day, finishing in 2 hours, 1 minute, and 39 seconds. Tomorrow, in Vienna, Kipchoge will run 26.2 miles again. But it's not an official race. He'll be the only competitor, and he has a specific goal. He wants to run it in under 2 hours, 1:59:59. So yeah, tomorrow Kipchoge is running a marathon. But if he breaks 2 hours, his time would go into the record books with a lot of asterisks next to it. Here's sports physiologist Ross Tucker.
I think that the human barrier of sub 2 hours is a significant one. But if it happens this weekend, I don't know how to evaluate it in the context of whether it's a human in advance, a physiological advance, or simply a technical and logistical one.
Here's the setup. The course is really flat, and it's 90% straight, so Kipchoge won't have to waste time going around curves. The weather will be perfect for running a marathon. Cool temps, low humidity, no precipitation. In fact, organizers chose tomorrow precisely because of the forecast. Kipchoge also won't be alone. He'll have 41 pace setters hopping in and out of the course. These guys are world-class runners themselves, and they're trained to run at very specific paces to make sure he's on track to run under 2. They'll also shield him from any wind resistance. And finally, the shoes. He'll be wearing shoes that Nike claims make any runner faster. So with all that, Ross Tucker thinks Kipchoge's certainly capable of breaking 2 hours, at least in this environment.
I think the moment you put back all the constraints and the ceilings, the physiological ceilings that exist in those normal race situations, performance will go back to where it came.
This is actually the second time Kipchoge's tried to run under 2 hours in a highly controlled environment. In 2017, he missed the mark by 26 seconds. His time then didn't count as an official world record, and tomorrow's won't either. But still, the excitement for the run is building. Fans are expected to come out and watch, and you can buy t-shirts and hats emblazoned with the motto, "No human is limited." Of course, some people think it should say, "No human is limited if all other factors are absolutely perfect." But even if tomorrow's attempt is not quite natural, it's still a distinctly human feat. Because at the center of it all is a human. Eliud Kipchoge, a 34-year-old Kenyan father of 3. And he says he's doing this for one reason.
To inspire family, to inspire all human family in the whole world.
He says he wants to inspire the whole human family. And it's hard to argue with that. For The World, I'm Jessica Yarmosky.
The World's podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers at Goldman Sachs on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to the podcast Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics from a variety of sectors with far-reaching implications, including global and regional growth forecasts, finding value in today's investing climate, the impact of technology on markets, and much, much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
College students from Hong Kong studying abroad are missing a historic moment back home, but they're still protesting in places like Boston.
It's kind of like a way to offset my absence and my feeling of guilt.
On some campuses around the globe, scuffles have broken out between Chinese and Hong Kong students. Proxy battles over democracy coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. Today is the third day of Turkish attacks on Kurdish fighters in northern Syria. The assault began after President Trump's sudden removal of U.S. troops from the area. The Syrian Kurds are returning fire, launching shells and rockets into Turkey. There is a huge disparity in the number of people reported to have been killed or injured. What is clear, the Turkish-Syrian border is a scene of chaos and turmoil. According to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, the attacks have forced more than 60,000 Syrians from their homes. For Syrian refugees already in Turkey, the latest fighting is making tense times even more difficult. Reporter Duri Biskaran is based in Istanbul.
There are 3.6 million Syrian refugees who are officially registered in Turkey. The makeup of Syrian refugees is very much like the makeup of Syrians. You've got Syrian Kurds, you've got Syrian Turkmen, you've got Syrian Christians, Syrian Sunni Muslims. Many of them are concentrated in the southeastern part of the country, but it's thought that there are even more because many do not have registration formally. I've been talking to a lot of people, both Syrian and Turkish, and it's really difficult to speak about these issues publicly. They're in a country where speaking their mind and criticizing a military action is seen as a crime. I mean, already since this operation has begun, more than 100 people have been detained, according to Turkey's foreign ministry, for writing critical things on Twitter. So I spoke to half a dozen people on the record, but only one was willing to give their name.
So, not free to speak out, what is daily life like for Syrians in Turkey?
Many live in largely Syrian neighborhoods. They live here with their families, they go to school, but there's this added layer of instability. To give you an example, there's a checkpoint right by my house. I used to walk by it every single day, carrying a backpack, going to Turkish class, and I didn't know it was a checkpoint until I walked by it with my Syrian friend, and they stopped him immediately, even though we were speaking English. These checkpoints are at metro stations, they're on the street, and there's this scaling up of ID checks and raids at workplaces over the summer. I spoke to one 28-year-old student who's originally from Damascus who told me what that felt like.
I have a legal paper, but most of the people around me, they don't have, so I was all the time stressed. I have every day to call my friends one by one to ask, are you okay? Did you get home safely? For many months, it was something daily. And all of us, we already feel unsafe, but we start to feel unsafe more.
As for this Turkish military operation in northeast Syria, I mean, the Syrians you've spoken with in Turkey, how worried are they about these attacks?
I think it really depends on who you are. For Syrian Kurds here in Turkey, this is devastating. But I think for others, it's kind of frustration. There's a feeling that foreign intervention has intensified the conflict. It's creating these sectarian divides. And to them, the primary enemy should have been the dictator Assad, who's still in power and will likely regain control of the country. But a small number, I would say a minority of Syrians that I spoke to, were actually supportive, particularly a member of the Turkmen minority, which is a Turkish-speaking ethnic minority in Syria. He said that Turkey is a better option for people. If you're going to be in an area that's going to be controlled, Turkey is a better option than ISIS or Assad or even American-backed Kurds. His name is Samir Hafiz.
Some people, they could be afraid of thinking that Turkey is invading Syria. I don't think it is at all. If you look at what happened in Jarablus and El Bab and Afrin, they built schools, hospitals, very sophisticated.
Kind of surprising to hear that. What about the kind of threat from President Erdogan about opening up the borders and letting the Syrians flow into Europe? I mean, that seems to be what he's saying.
Right. When he says open the doors, it means creating policies that make it harder for Syrian refugees to live in Turkey and then scaling back the restrictions at the border, making it easier for people to leave on rafts to get to the Greek islands. Among Turks, about 80% was one opinion poll, wanted to send the refugees back to Syria. This is not only coming from Erdogan's own party, but from the opposition. He's used that in the past, and he's using it now as a form of pressure on European governments and the U.S. to accept more Syrian refugees. Turkey sees itself as taking the brunt of this crisis. But if you're a Syrian refugee, you feel really used. And I spoke to one 28-year-old student, and that's something that he told me.
We know very well how the Turkish government is playing with this card all the time. Why every time you need money from Europe, you say, I'm going to open the borders. Are we zombies or something? If you open the border, we are going to occupy Europe or something like that. We just want to live in peacefully in some place. We don't want to be this card for playing between all the countries.
Well, certainly a lot of reasons for Syrians and Turkey to be worried today. Duri Buscaran, a reporter based in Istanbul, thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Thank you.
There's another major player in this conflict, Russia. And this week, President Vladimir Putin and Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan had a phone conversation about the escalating conflict. Yuri Barman is the Middle East and North Africa director at the Moscow Policy Group. I asked him about that phone call.
According to the statements coming from the Kremlin, they were talking about the Turkish operation in the northeast of Syria. Vladimir Putin sort of green-lighted this operation, but he asked the Turkish president to be very careful so as not to derail the political process that is ongoing, setting up the Constitutional Committee.
And by be careful, what does that mean? Are there any red lines that Russia is warning Turkey not to cross?
The main red line, of course, for everyone is Syrian sovereignty. Syria should remain a united country. Of course, there are fears that this Turkish operation could grow into a buffer zone at the Turkish-Syrian border. The Syrian government is fully against this operation, as well as the Iranians, while the Russians are trying to be a little more flexible.
So you mentioned the Syrian Constitutional Committee. What is the Syrian Constitutional Committee, and why is Vladimir Putin so interested in it?
The Syrian Constitutional Committee is a body that is being formed under the United Nations. It's a body of 150 Syrians representing the opposition, the government, as well as the civil society. From 2 years back, I think the Syrian Constitutional Committee has been closely linked to the Astana process, the process that is led by Russia, Iran, and Turkey. And I think the fear here is that if the Turkish operation goes too far, the Iranians will not be interested in working with the Turks within the Astana format. So this is one of the red lines out there.
So as Turkish military operations continue in northern Syria, what is Russia's main goal?
I think the main goal for Russia is not really in the northeast. The main goal for Russia is in Damascus. And the main goal is to legitimize the Syrian government, legitimize Bashar al-Assad. Russia generally has been trying to set up the talks between Damascus and the Kurds. This process has been ongoing for a year, but it really didn't lead to anything. Now, I think Russians seek more rapprochement between the Turks and the Syrian government. There are very many conflicting interests in Syria, and Russia needs to balance between them. So I think to an extent, Russians are hedging in the northeast at the moment. They want to see who is going to be the first party that will reconcile with the Syrian government, basically.
Have Russian officials had any conversations recently with the Kurds in Syria?
Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, did receive some messages from the Kurds, apparently indicating that they are ready for talks with Damascus. But we've heard these statements for a very long time, including in January 2019 when Americans withdrew from Manbij. So there's a lot of suspicion that this is being used by the Kurds as leverage against the Americans. So yes, they are in constant contact with the Kurds, but unfortunately so far these contacts have not led to any rapprochement.
Do you think Turkey will stick to its promises to Russia to keep its ambitions limited in the north of Syria?
Well, look, first of all, Turkey didn't give any promises to the Russians. According to plan that the Turkish president presented to the UN General Assembly, Turkey's goal is setting up a buffer zone in the northeast. I don't think this is something that Russia would be happy with, because that automatically means that Turks do not really need the Astana process that is led by Russia. I think Russians still see Turkey's operations in the context of the Adana agreement that was signed in the 90s between the Syrian government and the Turkish government. That agreement stipulates that Turks have the right to conduct limited targeted operations in Syria, and I think this is exactly what Russians expect from the Turks.
Does Russia relish the opportunity to fill the vacuum left by the U.S.?
Yes, but in a different way. I think it just wants the government to come back. This has been their goal from the get-go. I don't think Russians have a genuine interest to manage the Syrian territory and to deal with every single problem. Russians just want a centralized government to come back. In terms of filling the void, it's very hard to imagine that Russians will be able to do that in the northeast, specifically in the areas closer to the Turkish border, because these areas are still self-governed, actually well-governed. There's there are NGOs, there's local administration councils. So I don't really think that Kurds expect Russians to fill that void.
So is Putin taking more of a watch, wait and see approach to see what happens next with Turkey?
I think that's exactly that. I mean, if Turkey goes too far, obviously Russians will have to react somehow. And there are ways how Russians could pull a plug by, for example, closing the airspace like they did before. But until Turkey really goes too far and sort of sets up its own administrations there, sets up observation posts, I don't think Russians will intervene in any way.
Yuri Barman, the Middle East and North Africa director at the Moscow Policy Group in Russia. Good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thanks.
This year, there have been multiple protests in France. People have taken to the streets over the rising price of fuel, climate change, and now fertility treatments. In vitro fertilization, or IVF, in the U.S., just about anyone can get IVF treatments if their insurance covers it or they pay out of pocket. But in France, IVF access has been restricted to a certain group. That may be about to change. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Isabelle Laurent and her boyfriend tried for years to have a baby. And when nothing else worked, they decided to try IVF. But then, halfway through the process, he dumped her.
He decided to break the relationship.
Isabel told me she remembers thinking that now she'd never get to be a mom.
The day he decided to do that, I was looking on the internet to find some other solution. I was 38. I knew that it would be perhaps too late for me.
So she decided to have a baby on her own. One problem, though. In France, single women aren't allowed to get IVF. They're also not allowed to freeze their eggs or get artificial insemination. Same thing for women in same-sex couples. In France, you can only access these fertility treatments if you're married to a man or if you're in a long-term heterosexual relationship, which puts France at odds with most other EU countries. But now France is in the process of liberalizing those laws.
Je suis favorable.
The push is being led by French President Emmanuel Macron. During his election campaign in 2017, he said the existing rules are a form of discrimination.
Cette discrimination. J'attendrai que...
There's legislation right now in front of the National Assembly that would extend IVF and other fertility treatments to single women and lesbian couples. The cost of the treatment would be paid for by the government, like it is now for straight couples, as long as the woman is under the age of 43. But this is all happening too late for Isabelle Laurent. She went to Belgium for IVF in 2015, and she gave birth to a baby girl. She says she was lucky to be able to afford the treatment.
Oui, c'est cher. Oui, c'est expensive.
More than $5,000. Again, in France, if she had been married, it would have been free. And there are other complications.
C'est pas facile parce qu'il faut trouver quand même des médecins en France qui
IVF isn't just one procedure and you're done. Isabelle says she needed to find a doctor in France who would prescribe hormone shots, even though it was technically not allowed. And she said it made her feel like an outlaw.
Hors loi. On a un peu l'impression d'être hors la loi.
So Isabelle and I spoke for a while, and she spent maybe 15 minutes defending her decision to have a kid alone, explaining to me that alternative family structures are valid, referencing anthropology, kinship models, you name it. She was trying really hard to justify to me something that I never challenged her on. And it's not too hard to see why. The IVF debate has become a new front for the culture wars in France. France has a reputation of being pretty relaxed when it comes to sex, but occasionally a Catholic-tinged conservative resistance bubbles up. It happened in 2013 with large protests against legalizing same-sex marriage, and now it's happening again. Over the weekend, tens of thousands of people took to the streets in Paris to protest the IVF bill. Their slogan was Liberty, Equality, and Paternity, a play on liberty, equality, and fraternity. Ludovine de la Rochère is the president of Manif pour Tous, the group that organized this protest and the anti-gay marriage protest in 2013.
The law means that we would choose voluntarily to deprive children of a father. And it will be terrible injustice.
There's something very French about this anxiety, this fear of men getting displaced. Alice Coffin is with the LGBT French Journalists Association.
I think there is a huge sexism in French culture.
And as an example, Coffin points to the backlash against the Me Too movement in France, where Catherine Deneuve and a group of other women wrote an open letter to the French newspaper Le Monde saying Me Too was fueled by a hatred of men.
And this whole demonstration and all the public discussion we're having on IVF is pretty much about how worried part of the French population is about fathers and actually men disappearing.
That fear might not be enough to stop the IVF bill. Polls show a majority of French voters support expanding access to fertility treatments. The IVF bill still has to make its way through the Senate, but it is widely expected to pass. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Anger continues to grow in Hong Kong. Officials there revealed that in the past 4 months, 750 of the protesters arrested were children under the age of 18. That's nearly a third of the total arrests. More protests are expected this weekend, even across the globe on college campuses. Supporters of both the democracy protesters and Beijing are facing off against one another. One of those confrontations recently happened here in Boston. My WGBH colleague Anna Kusmer has a story.
On most Tuesdays, the area outside the dining hall at Emerson College in Boston is relatively quiet. But October 1st was not a typical Tuesday. It was the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. And that day, a protester in Hong Kong had been shot and wounded by police.
No, the government, the government's responsibility have you ever is been to a protest listen before? To the people.
Here at Emerson, students from mainland China confronted three students from Hong Kong, holding signs accusing the Hong Kong police of murder. Over the past 4 months, hundreds of protesters in Hong Kong have been injured in clashes with police, though no deaths have been reported. Francis Hoy, a journalism student from Hong Kong, organized the Emerson protest.
It's kind of like a way to offset my absence and my feeling of guilt because I'm not able to be in Hong Kong to participate in the movement.
One of the mainland Chinese students involved in the argument was Bainey Wang from Shanghai. She, too, is a journalism major at Emerson and the president of the Chinese Student Association. She says she was upset to see her country accused of murder on one of its most important national holidays.
It was our national day, so everyone was super happy, and it was a big day for all of us. And then you're not going to be happy if someone to tell you that your government and your country is a murder.
On-campus scuffles between mainland Chinese and Hong Kong students have broken out in other schools across the U.S. and around the world. Beneath the fighting lies a deep schism. Hong Kong is part of China, but it's semi-autonomous and has a degree of press freedom and free expression that the mainland does not. Students from Hong Kong, for example, can be critical of their government in ways that students from mainland might find unthinkable.
The two groups of students who hold strong opposite views on Hong Kong understand the protest completely differently. That's partly because their news sources are different, but also their identities are different.
Shen Lu is a journalist in New York who writes about the Chinese diaspora. She says media read by the pro-Hong Kong protesters largely portrayed demonstrators in Hong Kong as fighting righteously for self-determination, while Chinese media portray them as rioters stoking separatism.
Chinese students have been taught since they were young kids that Western media is biased against China. You know, a lot of what they see in international reports reinforces this idea that Western media are against China.
Shen Lu says many Chinese students studying abroad are hearing criticism of the Chinese government for the first time. Bainey Wang, the Chinese student at Emerson, says she was home in Shanghai when she first read about the Hong Kong protests on Chinese social media. Now that she's in the U.S., she reads both Chinese news sources and Western outlets, like the New York Times.
Yeah, it's definitely a pretty different perspective, and that's why I'm also, like, questioning the media nowadays.
On both sides or on one side?
Yeah, on both sides.
Wang says she knows the protesters at Emerson are from Hong Kong, and she understands why they're so passionate about the issue. But she still finds overt criticism of China hurtful. Frances Hoy, the student from Hong Kong, says she's sympathetic to mainland Chinese students who have to deal with an authoritarian government even when they're studying in the U.S. She says she knows their private messages are surveilled by their government.
So I wouldn't, point at their face and say, educate yourself on this, because I know it's also difficult for them.
Shen Lu, the journalist, says most mainland Chinese and Hong Kong students on U.S. campuses have complex feelings about the protests and China's role in the world, even if they're not always able to express those views publicly. For The World, Anna Kusmer, Boston.
Hong Kong is not the only thing on the mind of Chinese President Xi Jinping today. That's because he's in India for weekend meetings with Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Xi and Modi are talking trade between their nations. They'll also be discussing an awkward topic, Kashmir. Awkward because parts of Kashmir are controlled by Pakistan, India, and a small slice by China. India's portion is its only Muslim-majority state. This summer, Delhi revoked the semi-autonomous status of Kashmir and put a severe curfew on the region. That outraged Pakistan. Masood Khan is president of the Pakistani part of Kashmir. When Khan was in Washington recently, I asked him what he wants to see happen in Kashmir.
We would like to see a referendum held under the auspices of the United Nations. There were nearly a dozen resolutions which were passed way back in the 1950s, and they remain unimplemented. These resolutions are important because they recognize Kashmiris as the key party to the dispute. I mean, there are three parties, India, Pakistan, and the people of Jammu and Kashmir, and the people of Jammu and Kashmir have to decide their future.
Prime Minister of Pakistan Imran Khan warned that war was still possible over this Indian crackdown in its part of Kashmir. So how concerned are you about war? Is your administration making any preparations for the worst?
We are making further preparations because we have been threatened directly. An attack on the Indian-occupied Kashmir is an attack on Azad Kashmir in Pakistan. There's a potent threat of war, and we are preparing to defend ourselves.
Now, India also says terrorist groups are based in your territory, supported by Pakistani intelligence. What is your view of the, have to say it, many terror-like attacks in Indian-occupied Kashmir?
Well, I think that the version or interpretation of what terrorism is dated, and their accusations are dated also. I would say that we never call these people fighting for the realization of the right to self-determination terrorists. We always call them freedom fighters. But let me tell you that this accusation of terrorists being trained and being sent across the line of control, these are false and fictitious. There are no terrorist camps in Azad Kashmir. So I think that this accusation has no substance. They say this because they want to speak to the world's concern about terrorism worldwide.
So you say there are no terrorist training camps in Azad Kashmir.
Can you say
for the record that there are no separatist militants on the soil of your territory, Azad Kashmir?
Absolutely
either?
None. I can say that with authority and full authenticity.
Masood Khan, president of Pakistan-administered Kashmir, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
And that is The World This Week from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio. I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.